Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of A Voyage to Antarctica. I'm your host, Alok Jha. This week we're going to the ice with legendary explorer, author, fundraiser and public speaker, Sir Ranulph Fiennes. Sir Ranulph was described by the Guinness Book of Records as the world's greatest living explorer. That was back in 1984, and since then he's broken many more world records and led many more expeditions to this remote region. He's the only man alive to have ever travelled around the Earth's circumpolar surface. More people have been to the moon. His record-breaking expeditions include travel by riverboat, hovercraft, manhaul sledge, skidoo, Land Rover and ski, and have raised many millions of pounds for charity. He's the author of numerous books, including a biography of Robert Falcon Scott, and he's the vice patron of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. Sir Ranulph Fiennes, welcome. Can I ask you a question which I think is probably on the lips of everyone who hears your stories? What made you want to become an explorer?
Well, going back to sort of when I got born, 4 months after my dad had been killed in the Second World War, commanding the tank regiment, the Royal Scots Greys, at the great Battle of Alamein and so on, before he was killed near Monte Cassino. And I was brought up by my mum in South Africa to just adore my dead dad, and want to do nothing in my life other than become the colonel, as he was when he was killed, of the Scots Greys. So that was, for the first 18 years of my life, my one aim, not to explore or anything like that. And I had to go to Sandhurst College to get to be a regular British officer. And to do that, you needed to pass two A levels. And sadly, and I'm not blaming my education in South Africa, but I failed to get my A levels and therefore could not be a regular British officer. So I did the next best thing. I went to a cadet college and got a short service commission, hoping that somehow or other I could still get to be colonel of the regiment. But it turned out that that was no good. So I ended up on postings to various places, including for 2.5 years, seconded to the army of the Sultan of Oman in Arabia. And as part of that, found myself in very weird, remote parts of the greatest desert on earth, fighting the Soviet Union Yemenis from across the border in the Yemen. And I got a taste at that time, while still in the army, for travel in remote parts. And when I left, I had no sort of income, but with my wife and childhood sweetheart of many, many years, she decided that we could make a living, not military, but civilian, in the world of exploration in remote areas.
And so how did you go about choosing the first place you wanted to explore, the first challenge?
Well, the first challenge I managed to do while I was still under the sort of financial help of the British Army, which was during army leave with other army people to do one on ice quite close to the UK. We realised very quickly, me and Ginny, my late wife, that everything we did must be cost-free. We must be sponsored by every single thing, even on an expedition to Europe. And we did it to Norway's biggest glacier, the Jostedalsbrae. And we used parachutes to get 10,000 feet to 6,000 feet with all our survey gear. And we did it to help the Norwegian Hydrological Board under Dr. Gunnar Erstrom. And so we took army surveyors with us as well, having taught them to parachute. And that was the very first attempt. And basically, to get sponsorship, you need media coverage. We learned these lessons earlier on. To get media coverage, we would need to break world records, because that's what really makes the media interested in your group. So world records of a polar nature, because the Brits are keener on polar than hot stuff, as we soon discovered. To get that, we had to look into what polar records there were. And of course, there are only two real poles, up top and the bottom. And we discovered, to our annoyance, I suppose you could say, that most of the existing polar records, north and south, had already been broken by the Norwegians. They are the best in the world at that sort of thing, and we would have to somehow beat them. Ginny discovered that the one record that they tried to break and found impossible was to do the first ever circumpolar journey around planet Earth. Never been gone by any route by anybody ever. More people have been on the moon. That is what she decided we would go for. She decided that in 1972, a couple of years after we married.
Tell us about that journey. I mean, that was an epic trip that took many, many years to plan, that tens of thousands of miles. You know, when you had the idea, were you always confident that you'd be able to do it? Or was there a sort of element of fear and sort of anxiety about it as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was actually my wife, Ginny, whose idea it was serving up porridge one day. And I said, go around the world.
Is this the kind of conversation you have over breakfast?
Yeah, that's right. And I said to her, but Ginny, go around the world. Lots of people have been around the world. No, do it from south to north or north to south. That has definitely never been done, and only the Norwegians have tried doing it in bits. We will do it not in bits, but as a single 3 or 4 year journey of permanent travel, and we will go from the Thames, because we'll need a ship, because wherever you go, the oceans get in the way at some points, and we'll use a ship, which ice strengthened, obviously, to drop a land group off when we hit land that got in the way of a simple route, 0180. So zero starts at a place called Greenwich on the Thames. So get a ship, put your land group on the ship, leave Greenwich on the Thames and head down zero. First obstacle is called France. We'll unload Land Rovers on the port at Calais and say goodbye. You then go down till you hit the sea at Barcelona. The ship will go round and collect you from there, take you south down zero to the next obstacle, which is called Africa. Land Rovers would be dropped off, three of them. Land group would be ideally three people and a base commander. And the base commander would have to do the radio, therefore good at Morse code in those days. Because remember, in those days, there were no polar satellites, no polar orbiting satellites. So there was no GPS or sat-nav or sat-phone. You'd be using the same sextant or theodolite as Shackleton and Scott did all that few years before, maybe 50 or 60 years previously. But we would head on south, and whatever obstacle we hit before we reached the South Pole, we would not be allowed to fly 1 meter of the entire 3.5 year journey. To get the plan underway, once was agreed, Shackleton had tried crossing Antarctica, not the whole lot, and he had the help of the government through the Royal Navy. We would need help. Well, I had been in a regiment called the Special Air Service in the 60s. And although they had thrown me out after a year through blowing up civilian property with army explosives, which is not popular, they liked the idea of this expedition. And 7 years after I was chucked out, they sponsored us with headquarters in Sloane Square or up King's Road, which was free. And they helped us get permission from the Americans and the Danes and the, everybody who got in the way on the Zero Meridian. So we had that basis from which to get all the sponsors, including the ice-strengthened ship that we would need. And that came to, in 1972, £29 million worth, and we didn't spend a penny. We had 1,900 sponsors. We worked for 7 years in the SAS barracks without pay except Territorial Army, which we were in. And we got all the sponsorship, had no checkbook, no account, got Chubb Fire kindly sponsored us with the loan of a ski plane. We never flew in it ever, but it had to drop off things like prefab huts in the middle of Antarctica. And that's how we got going. 7 years unpaid, working in pubs in Chelsea to make a living to pay the gas bill back home.
When all of that preparation and all of that planning and all that sweat and hard work was done, how did you feel? What was the sort of emotion you had?
Well, the more time you spent, 7 years, and there's two of us, my wife and me, 14 years of our lives unpaid, you really want to succeed, not waste all that time. So it gives you a complete impetus to do everything, even if it was the opposite to which had been allowed legally before. So since the Foreign Office in the UK, the Polar Desk in Whitehall, categorically refused to let any Brit citizens travel in the middle of Antarctica except at bases on the coast during the 8 months of winter, that cut everything out basically, and we had to break that record with the help of the SAS persuasion of the Foreign Office and so on and so forth. And luckily the Norwegians also, their government stopped them going.
So what was in your mind when you were organising all this, when you were trekking all that way and doing all of this work? What was the purpose of the expedition? What did you think you wanted to achieve from it? Was it about raising awareness of places, or was it just the challenge that you wanted to conquer?
Initially, as I've said, we wanted to break the world record, whether it was looking for a lost city, which we were doing in Arabia, or whether we first of all want to do the circumpolar journey around Earth, to break a record as a British, well, international, because we recruited people on the ship, for instance, for 4 years unpaid, might come from Fiji or America or Canada or South Africa, from 9 different countries, in fact. So we needed a co-leader. The base commander and radio operator would be Ginny. I would be the leader of the ICE group, in the icy areas like Antarctica, the Arctic, and the Northwest Passage. And Anton Bauring volunteered to be the marine leader for all the marine bits. So we delegated into three, and that's how we got going.
So let me take you back to the turn of the 20th century when explorers were trying to discover and, you know, work out what Antarctica was all about. When you were planning your own expeditions, when you were thinking about your kind of career and your future career in exploration, were you looking back to these sorts of heroes like Scott and Shackleton?
If they were relevant, anybody who tried to do what we were trying to do bit by bit, like Shackleton one bit, Scott another bit, Sir John Franklin, the Northwest Passage bit, all of them were killed. And Amundsen, all those people did an expedition, but we were trying to do all their expeditions in a single journey over 3 years, probably, depending on how we did. And we would have scientific work to do as well. Incidentally, in the mid-1990s, a Canadian magazine said that all my expeditions had no scientific content. So we sued them in high court with a jury of 12 people in London, and they had to pay £100,000. We showed them the 600-page scientific report, which had come out just of that one expedition, because of all the scientists that we took with us, like two oceanographers for 3 years on the ship, and so on and so forth. So science is a big part of it, even if we don't go into it in a big detail. Charity, our expeditions to date have raised just on £18.9 million for various, mostly UK charities like Multiple Sclerosis, Marie Curie, Breakthrough Cancer, and so on. So charity, science, and breaking the world record under the name of the UK, even if it's an international team.
The descriptions you make of the kinds of expeditions that these explorers made or tried to make in at the turn of the 20th century, I mean, they sound horrific to those of us who are not explorers. They sound very grueling. I wonder when you try and bring these things to life, what is it about those stories that you want people to know? What is it about the explorers of the past that you think we, as living comfortably right now, should know?
Well, lessons learned. We learned, don't take anybody on your team who's had previous frostbite. That's one little lesson. Don't take people when you on site just because they've been on some other expedition. Check them out that they are good-natured, not egotistical, and not sort of when they get into very bad circumstances, any sort of failing character-wise is going to be exacerbated, and make sure that they have a very strong motivational power in order that when they're really getting gangrene and crutch rot, which they will do sooner or later on one of these big record-breaking expeditions, otherwise that record would have been done by previous people like the Norwegians. So you know you're going to run into big trouble, and you know you need people who will, when the weak, wimpish voice comes into their head, telling them that they've got to stop, they might get gangrene and have amputations, is it worth carrying on? They've got to beat that voice in their head by their willpower. That's the sort of person you want to choose. And we've had 4,000 people applying for one expedition, and we only wanted two of them.
When you describe it like that, when you talk about the selection and the psychological temperament, it almost sounds a bit like when NASA advertises for astronauts and they go through quite a grueling procedure to actually decide who gets to go up in the rockets or who's going to go to Mars next.
Oh, but there's one big difference there, Alec, I'm afraid. Very big difference. For the people going into astronaut stuff, never mind having to speak Russian, they need to be intelligent. They need to pass A-levels. Our people don't. We don't like too much intelligence.
I'm sure that you're exaggerating a little bit. I'm sure they have to be fairly intelligent to sort of get themselves across such incredible landscapes. How do you prepare? I mean, how do you prepare? Once you've got your team, what do you do? If you think you're going to go across Antarctica, what's the sort of process to prepare your body and your mind?
Well, you've got an ice group. And as I say, they've pretty much been chosen and intelligence hasn't been particularly part of it. So if we know that we're going to have communications, Morse code mostly, then we will, in the TA, Royal Signals, maybe 4 years, train them to become expert at Morse, as my wife was. She became the only woman ever to have been given the Polar Medal by the Queen from all her ionospheric scientific work, which she was trained to do at Cove Radio and Sheffield University into ionospherics, which is groundbreaking. And that's what she would have to do during periods like for 8 months when we were stuck in a little hut together, 400 miles into Antarctica, 800 miles from human beings. If we had tooth problem or appendix, which we could, we had to have one trained to remove the appendix and to do whatever in the mouth of the person. So one of our people out of the three, myself, Oliver Shepherd and Charlie Burton, Ginny was there, but she was just on the radios and so on. And one of the three had to be chosen to be the dentist. So Chelsea Barracks, Territorials, 2 months training for Ollie Shepherd, who had been a beer salesman previously. And Ollie Shepherd was taught how to take out teeth. He was lent medical equipment, which looked like a Gestapo torture kit. And for 8 months down in Antarctica and 8 months up in the Arctic later, living in a hut on the edge, waiting for summer before we could try and cross them, we had tooth trouble and that you eat, however bad the pain in your mouth was, you didn't dare go to Ollie Shepherd and his medical kit. He was also taught at Chelsea Barracks how to remove appendix. And when 3.5 years later we were in Antarctica, he'd sort of forgotten which side they were on. But, you know, we did, to answer your question, have training in various skills which we knew nothing about, including in the Northwest Passage, two-stroke motor repairs and Skidoo two-stroke engines. So we got sent to the sponsor who was actually giving us that equipment, Land Rover, for instance, in the Sahara section. Yeah, so we had to do an awful lot of different courses, and Ollie Shepherd, the ex-beer salesman, was the one with a little bit of intelligence, so he got all of them.
What about the physical part of the training? Do you have to learn how to just deal with cold in some way, or is that just something you do when you get there?
Yeah, I mean, out of the 4,000 people I'm talking about who applied, a lot of them, we made them join the territorial SAS, which has a selection course, which got rid of pretty much all of them without us having to look at them. The ones who got through, to answer your question, we would take weekends in the Territorial Army to do the Welsh 3000 race. And that checked them out very much indeed in mountainous terrain. And we used to take 16 of the applicants at a time to Capelcurig Village Hall, free accommodation, and run them over the Welsh 3000 course, and got rid of a lot that way.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you got to Antarctica, you've been many times, but just if you think back to one of the times you've been and you've had a moment to pause and reflect when you're there, when you're not sort of trudging, you know, and making your way across, what is it like for people who've not been? How would you describe the experience of being there?
Well, you're in a hut. I'm telling you about our way, not the way if you end up in the British Antarctic Survey base. That's different. And you'll have plenty of scientific work all the time. And probably a couple of other people. Well, when we were in Antarctica for 8 months, 600 miles from people, basically, there was Ollie Shepherd, Charlie Burton, myself, and Ginny, so the base commander radio operator. So four people, and all the time you've got work. Ollie Shepherd had been trained, obviously, by the World WMO, Meteorological Organization, very, very handy, because for all that area, they had no one sending them weather results. So filling in a big area of unknown stuff. And he would daily, with Ginny on Morse code, send all the Met reports, as other people in the British Antarctic Survey were doing. And we were in touch with them by Morse as well. We would send back to either Exeter, or wherever it happened to be, the WMO British Centre, every day. Now, in a British base, there would be two or more Met people doing that, because every 6 hours you have to report. Well, for that entire 8 months, Ollie Shepherd, the beer salesman, having been trained by Bracknell, I think it was in those days, by the WMO, trained meticulously to be as good as they were, and given all the anemometers and other equipment recording, he'd be outside in blizzards even, checking those instruments, and then going to Ginny, he would have to get through via Portishead Radio ship radio to get onto the British phone system if she was lucky. Otherwise, Morse code through straight to Cove Radio in Farnborough.
You were clearly working very hard, but what was the actual experience of being in Antarctica like? I mean, was it a peaceful place in some ways? Was it miserable? What was it like?
Well, it depends on your job. I mean, Ollie Shepherd, I've just been talking about, and he twice got carbon monoxide poisoning in the generator hut because he had to keep the generators going, which is the only power source. And we're in, 400 miles from anywhere. We're about, 5,000 feet above sea level. It's very, very cold. Our hut was made of cardboard because it had to be light, dropped off by parachute, as I told you earlier on. And yeah, you're living in a cardboard hut with that sort of circumstance. Luckily, the huge snowdrifts came up almost to the level of the roof, which gave you steadiness against the big winds, but didn't help with the cold. Relations were fine. I was up one end of the hut with Ginny, my wife, and Ollie and Charlie were up the other end, and they had the joy of looking after Ginny's Jack Russell Terrier, the first dog ever to have, according to Guinness Book of Records, peed on both poles.
You've talked to us about preparation for expeditions. You've talked to us about the expeditions themselves and what goes on. Some expeditions are successful and some aren't. That's just the nature of the kind of enterprise you're engaged in. For you, if an expedition doesn't work, if you don't get to do what you intended, whether it's the record-breaking activity or you don't get to the place you need to get to, how does it make you feel? Is it something that defeats you? Clearly doesn't defeat you because you try again, but how does it make you feel?
The first time you fail, you realise you're going to have to try again. And just as one example in this century, I think around about 2002, I had a massive heart attack at Bristol Airport, double bypass, and 3 days on a life support machine and so on. And a little bit after that, I was due to climb Mount Everest for a charity, I can't remember which charity, on the Tibetan side with a black South African friend of mine, Sibu Sisu. And on the last night, at 27,500 feet above sea level, I had another heart attack and was very lucky to have got pills, glycerine trinitrate, which I took, and 3 days later managed to get down to the base camp. And I'd failed. And to answer your question, it felt very bad on behalf of my sponsor, on behalf of the charity, and so on. So what you do, again, to answer your question, is you try again. But you don't have to try on that side. You can go two sides of Mount Everest, the Tibetan side or the Nepali side. And so I tried with the Nepali side about 3 years later, by which time I presume my heart would have got better. And on that side, we passed three bodies, one a friend of mine. And on the again, 5 hours from the summit at the buttress near the Hillary step, we saw a bloke being buried who was a wonderful climber. He'd just been to the top with no oxygen, and they were burying him. It had a bad effect on my morale. And again, I wimped out and didn't make it. But the following year, which by then I was an old age pensioner, my charity at that time had made over 4 million. And they thought, well, look, it doesn't really matter if you succeed this time, at least have a third go. And we should make over 2 million from the nice British public in £5 donations and that sort of thing. So I thought, well, why not have a go? So in 2009, but this time I was with an amazing Sherpa, sadly died last year in an avalanche, but a great guy called Tundu Sherpa. And he didn't treat me just as another tourist. He watched closely what I was doing wrong and therefore managed to get me at night instead of by day. That's not to be approved of, but at least it means you're not there with lots of other people. And so we got to the top, no bother at all. First old age pensioner to get to the top.
I tell you what, if I ever have a heart attack, I think it's going to be my cue to relax and not do anything like this. Clearly, you're made of different stuff to me, which is why you're an explorer and I'm not. You talked about learning from failures. Let me ask flip the question around. For you, you've done so many things that are, to most people, incredible. What's success for you? There's all of these adventures. If you got to the across the Antarctic, or you get to both the poles, you do them. Does it all become kind of work a day, or are you excited when you get to the end of each of these as well? What does success look like for you?
After 2005, the failure in Tibet, I realized that part of the failure, which had to do with the heart attack, was that I was very competitive, which I think is a bad thing. And so I thought, well, how can I do better? And my wonderful mountain guide, Kenton Kuhl, who'd been up Everest 14 times or maybe more by now, said, well, you want to do some proper climbing, not mountaineering like Everest, proper climbing. And he said, I will teach you to get rid of your horrible vertigo, which I suffered from, because on Everest you don't get vertigo, because if you look down, there's just a sort of white slope, not a drop. He said, I know somewhere much cheaper to get to, just in the Alps, called the north face of the Eiger, and it's sort of 6,000 foot drop, and I will teach you how to lose your vertigo, and that'll give you the confidence on Everest. So that's sort of zigzag way of doing these things.
And did you lose your vertigo?
I'm sorry. Oh, no. I did get to the top of the north face of the Eiger with Kenton and his partner, Ian Parnell. But I learned soon after that, to my horror, that when I wasn't with them, the vertigo came back.
I don't blame you. can I ask you, you've been to the poles multiple times in your adventures. What is it about the poles that fascinates you?
Well, getting there when you're doing records is the key thing. And planning how to get there is important when it's changing all the time. And you can't just say, because Amundsen got there on that particular route, that route's going to be the same as it was when he did it. You can't say that sort of thing. You've got to keep up with the Joneses. And the Antarctic heritage. We advise people, and the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge advises people on what to do and what not to do, and that's very important.
Yeah. Just finally then, can I ask you, we're asking everyone this question, why does Antarctica matter to you?
Antarctica matters in a huge way because I'm a human being, and human beings now, you know, if they live like on Exmoor, we are high enough to survive Antarctica's worst crash. So if the ice areas just get a little bit too hot at the bottom where they rub on rock, and we're talking about maybe a kilometre thick ice block sitting on 10,000 foot high mountains down there, if they start sliding down into the sea, you're going to raise the level of, and this is absolutely, you know, quite on the cards now, sadly. And the people who could get us down to below the 2%, which you've heard of, don't, because each government wants to be economically sound. And being economically sound doesn't always rub with doing good climatic behaviour.
Would you? Do you have any plans to go anywhere next for your
adventures? We certainly do. And our enemy, I mean our rivals, the Norwegians, would love to know what it is. So I'm not telling you.
So we'll find out when we find out. I guess. All right, Sir Ranulf, it's been an absolute pleasure to hear your stories about your exploring and about Antarctica. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alok. Cheers.
A Voyage to Antarctica was presented by me, Alok Jha. It was produced by Jessica Norman, with Ben Hewis as digital producer. Music was composed by Alec Hughes. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. A Voyage to Antarctica is part of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust's Antarctica in Sight programme, celebrating and reflecting on the past 200 years of human endeavour across this fascinating continent. The UK Antarctic Heritage Trust is the charity championing the public understanding of and engagement with Antarctica. You can find out more at www.ukaht.org. Next time, I'll be talking to Professor Dame Jane Francis, Director of the British Antarctic Survey, about Antarctica's unique role in the climate crisis. See you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.